Like the show? Want to listen to episodes early? Consider becoming a patron. Starting at the $3 a month level, patrons get access to a custom patron-only feed where we put out episodes of upstairs studio podcasts like the Childcare Bar and Grill, Miss Becky's Classroom, That Early Childhood Nerd, the Renegade Rules podcast, and others early. That feed is just for patrons. You could be one of them. Go to patreon.com/playvolutionhq or click the link in the show description to learn more. Childcare Bar and Grill podcast. Jeff Johnson, who's live from upstairs studio. With me is Lisa Murphy.
Good morning, Jeff.
Lisa just performed a little bit of self-surgery before we started recording, so she wouldn't be distracted, so you could have her full attention. A block-based splinter in the finger. Is that where it came from?
I have no idea. No, I was writing about blocks, so I was I was joking that even just thinking about blocks to me is so powerful that it impacts my body.
were you using a pencil and you kind of you had a thought and you snapped the pencil in your hand and got a little
bit of a pencil?
I think people don't snap enough pencils nowadays. I keep pencils on the desk just so when I have one of those moments, I can snap one just for fun.
Better a pencil than somebody's neck.
Yeah, exactly. Hey, so we're back with part two of our mini series looking at Ellen Sandster's six categories of risky play. I put a flyer handout kind of thing together on the Playvolution HQ page about this a while back. The first ones we talked about were great heights, rapid speeds, and dangerous tools, three categories of risk that children tend to be drawn to. This episode, we're going to get into dangerous elements, rough and tumble, and disappearing or getting lost. So dangerous elements. Lisa Murphy, thoughts?
Thoughts, dangerous elements. So I think I'm going to refer back to your handout here. It's children are seeking opportunities to engage with potentially dangerous elements such as fire, deep, cold, or moving water. This to me brings up literally the elements, not necessarily dangerous play with them, but how much opportunity do children have to interact with fire, with water, with air, with the dirt. And I think it reminded me a little bit of the recapitulative play. I don't know if you recall back that when we were unpacking Bob Hughes's characteristics.
It's like 16.
Yeah, the types of play according to Hughes, and recapitulative play being that one where it's like they're somehow plugging into like prehistoric play, you know, war and fire and throwing spears at each other. And this made me think of that, although I doubt that's perhaps where she was going with it. But being around water.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean,
and it doesn't need to be white rapids, right? It could be even splashing perhaps in a little kiddie pool.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I mean, this one makes me think about, I forgot, who is it? Kim, one of our listeners out in the Puget Sound area, Washington State, revised their regulations a few years back. And she was distraught because the way her reading of them was that would mean no walks along the shore. Because just too fucking dangerous, those kind of things, and so it's this elemental thing, and so fire and water are two big ones here. But I mean, even when it comes to dangerous elements, I don't know, are sticks dangerous elements, Lisa Murphy? Because I mean, you could put a fucking eye out.
You could,
I don't know if that fit. I don't know if that fits here. What about really windy days or going outside when it's raining and those kind of.
I think that's. And again, at the last session, I said I hadn't yet. I haven't read her dissertation. I would be curious to see if her definition of elements are the elements, so to speak. But if we stretched it, then yeah, definitely sticks, rocks, pebbles.
Yeah, you know, I like
find on the beach.
Yeah, I liked back, and I didn't do this much in the center days because I hadn't evolved to that point then, I guess, mostly, but and it was just easier to do it in family child care, but being outside with kids on bad weather days, mm-hmm. You know, not playing golf in a thunderstorm, but going outside in thunderstorms, absolutely, when it's raining hard, those hard spring rains that we get here in Iowa, and snowstorms, blizzard conditions, when I mean, it's almost whiteout conditions, and still getting outside to play for a few minutes, because being able to persevere that, I mean, when you're three, and you go outside on a day where the snow is so heavy and the wind is so strong that you literally
fall down.
Yeah. You literally can barely walk and can't see more than 3 feet in front of you. It's you feel big and powerful when you survive. I mean, but that's the way you feel when you're little like that. And it's cold out and it's windy out and everybody's going to take 20 minutes to get bundled up. But for them, it's this big adventure and interaction with these natural elements of the world.
And I think I have a couple of thoughts with that. One, that element of having your full body involved with something, right? You're feeling that wind absolutely everywhere and learning how to adjust your center of gravity to learn how to kind of stay strong and not get toppled over. The other thing that I'm thinking about is having those interactions with the natural elements when you're younger would tend to make.
You froze up for a second. I hope you unfreeze. It's gonna be bad pod if you don't unfreeze. Hey, so we lost Lisa for a couple seconds there. We're back. Her internet went out completely. We think it's because this is such a dangerous episode. The educrats don't want you to hear if they don't want you engaging in these kind of risky plays. So they actually literally snuck up and cut Lisa's internet connection.
She sent
the security team out there. I had Kenny, our podcast intern, take the shuttlecraft down to Florida and get it put back together for her. So we should be good to go. Lisa, do you remember where you were? You were just starting to say something about dangerous elements.
I'm distracted in the sense that I might be repeating myself, but the first thing I was thinking of was, because I had two things I wanted to say, the whole idea of that full body interaction with the wind or with the snow, and figuring out how to adjust your balance, your center of gravity to kind of withstand that. But then also just the development of environmental values, right? If you've been outside and experienced a stream, a river, wind, you know, the beach, climbing a mountain, you know, something that might appear inherently risky because you are out in the elements, I think you're more inclined to develop environmental values, which are, as we know, harder to instill in adults as you get older if you don't have any kind of memory to attach that to. You know, somebody's telling you that it's important to save the beaches or not to cut down the redwood forest. And, you know, if you've actually been out there, I think you're a little bit more inclined to pause and reflect on that.
Yeah, I totally agree. I think another one is the opportunity to be uncomfortable in a safe environment when you're talking about the cold and the wind and the wet. And actually there appears to be some relation to those that discomfort, kind of throwing your body into a little bit of discomfort and brain development and learning and perseverance and all those kind of things. I mean, there are a lot of people that are touting ideas of like cold water plunges, because it kind of shocks the system, right? And wakes up. And wakes up the brain. And so the same thing about going out on cold days and being able to be wet and cold and survive it. it doesn't take a whole lot of wet or cold to make you uncomfortable when you're three. And so there's that side of it as well, I think.
Which doesn't mean that you're going to be throwing the toddlers into a tub of ice filled water, just for clarification.
No, you're not throwing them into it. But I think I loved having ice water in the water play table so that they had the opportunity to touch it. On a STEM side of things, there's the ice in there, and then it's there out all the day, all throughout the day, and over the day it melts and everything. But in that when it's really icy cold and there's a bazillion ice cubes in the water play table, it was uncomfortable to play in, and they still played in it. Mm-hmm. Because again, it's this drawn to these dangerous elements. I also think
there's an element of, and perhaps I'm reading into this a little bit, of self-regulation there as well. You know, like, hey, I am cold, or, you know, maybe one kid isn't as cold as I am, or one kid has a little bit more tolerance, or maybe I'm the kid that has a little bit more tolerance and it doesn't seem as cold to me. And I think that might be good observation for the adults in the room as well. Cause you know, there's always that one kid that's like, I don't need a jacket, you know, and it's 40 degrees or 30 degrees or whatever. And I think we're quick to be like, yes, you do. Just put your stupid jacket on, you know, and go outside. But you know, maybe that kid is now unbearably hot and sweaty and uncomfortable because we're not listening to them. And so I think providing opportunities for a little bit of extreme might allow us to be gathering more information about the kids as well.
Yeah, absolutely. And so I think this one is a great one. I think in my travels back when we traveled, I think Australia is further ahead than the US on this one by far, I think, when it comes to the fire and water play. I mean, at a lot of the public parks, there are water elements where there's pumping stuff and especially the playgrounds close to the beaches. But programs are intentionally, because they've done the risk benefit of assessments and doing fire experiences with kids a lot more over there than they are here in the States. I think this is also a great one. The dangerous elements, I think, come into play in forced school settings, of course, a lot more than they do in standard early learning settings. And so there's a lot that can probably, if you're in a center and looking at how to do these things, looking up a forest school program on the Facebook or social media and seeing how they go about doing things is probably a good place to start if this is something you want to offer more of. But it's mostly wrapping your head around the quote unquote danger and realizing it's not really as dangerous as we might make it out to be, and then just looking for opportunities to plop those experiences in front of kids.
Well, yes, and the thought I just wanted to have here before we moved on was that the elements in and of themselves are not dangerous, but sometimes the way they're perceived or the specific situation immediately at hand, but you know, I think we need to not jump to the conclusion that just because there's a body of water that all eight kids are going to drown today, you know?
Yeah.
But I think in the name of safety and protection and licensing, we'll often knee jerk and just say no, because it's easier in our brain anyway. We think it's going to be easier to just say you're not allowed to do that, when I really actually think that it ends up requiring more energy and makes us more frustrated. Like, let's figure what part of this element can we say yes to? Yeah. And then, as we talked about the last couple episodes, is baby stepping towards it. You know, maybe there are going to be some boundaries or some rules or some expectations. And then maybe as experience and time goes by, they might get relaxed a little bit, which is, I think being willing to sign up for that method of dealing with an element is more effective, dare I say, than just outright shutting it down.
I mean, those eight kids, it's even unlikely that even four of them will drown in that small body of water. I mean, just statistically, it's just probably not going to happen. I think of the six of these, this one and Great Heights are the hardest for people to wrap their heads around. And I guess that's kind of a generalization, but that's been my experience talking about these with people that, I guess they're all kind of problematic for some people.
I could see some people being totally calm and cool and collected around a stream, you know, or a lake, but lose their shit if you say, let's give them hammers, nails, and a saw. Yeah. You're like, nope.
Yeah, I guess there's a lot of personal preference, personal demons involved in these. Let's move on to number 5, rough and tumble. Children, this is going to be a big news alert, people. Children seem to be drawn to rough and tumble. Lisa, have you noticed this? This is new to me. I hadn't.
You hadn't noticed this? Yeah. As the oldest of 5, I knew that this happened even before I knew that it had a name. Because, 3 brothers and a sister who was raised between the brothers. So, they were all rolling around and wrestling with each other and learning the boundaries. And we've unpacked this topic so many times. We've had guests on, we've read the books and I'm not in any way implying that we've exhausted the topic, because that never happens. And we are probably on the side of the spectrum that embraces it, that welcomes it, which what I will say though, and because I still always say this, I might not make a grand announcement, to a new group of kids. Hey, you're in Miss Lisa's class now. You're allowed to roll around and wrestle with each other. But when it happens, what the children are going to see is that I don't instantaneously shut it down. And for some children, that is like, ooh, that's different than the last place I was. What's this going to look like tomorrow?
Yeah. When I do sessions that touch on rough and tumble and probably all of these, one way I've been framing it is that although we as the adults don't like the aesthetics of these things, they just don't look right to us. It doesn't look right when kids are running around pretending to shoot each other, or that they're fighting each other, or they're all messy, or whatever it is. There's a lot of aesthetics that we bring into what early learning should look like as adults that really may not gel with what the kids are getting out of it. And so we've got to find this way of balancing what we think early childhood should look like with what the kids need and what they're drawn to. And they are totally drawn to these 6 things, although those 6 things are totally not aesthetically pleasing to the eye of a lot of early childhood people and parents.
Yeah.
So, like you said, we talk about it. The way I wrote it up in the flyer was, children seek opportunities to play, fight, wrestle, chase, sword fight with sticks or pool noodles, etc. And it's hard. You a collection of 6 or 8 kids, it's hard not to have 5 or 8 kids in that group that aren't going to be drawn to some version of this. And I think most of these things are just kind of evolutionarily who we are as humans, but so much of this one I think comes from the media that kids are exposed to as well. If they're watching movies and seeing TV shows and playing video games that are rough and tumble, they're going to be drawn to that. And if you are a parent who is totally not exposed to your child to those kinds of media in their early years, they're probably still going to be drawn to it. Now, it might be that innate evolutionarily airy thing, or it could be the fact that you may think you have total control over what they're seeing and you don't, even at really young ages, because you don't know what grandma and the babysitter are showing them, even if they tell you they're not. So, whatever it is, kids are drawn to this stuff.
And I'll remind our listeners that we tend to apply, I think probably if I was probably more to this one than the other ones, but maybe because I just haven't really stopped to apply it. I know one of the things we talk about with rough and tumble play is, again, Peter Gray, and that first condition of play is that it's freely chosen and I can quit when I'm done. So the implied, the setup is that if you don't want to do this, nobody's going to make you do it. Right. So it's not like it's rough and tumble time. So go get a sparring partner and find a place on the mat, because this is when we're all going to roll around and wrestle. If you don't want to do it, you don't have to do it. And so then if there's a kid who wants to engage in it, but can't seem to find a willing player, right. Then there's a little bit of self-regulation there. I understand you want to do this. Nobody was wanting to play like this with you right now. What are our options? And, it would be curious to me, is filtering the other 5 elements of risky play through that same thought process. You know, is no, nobody's telling you to climb to the top of the tree, right? Nobody's telling you to ride the bike as fast as you can.
Yeah. Well, and I mean, it's only play as if it's only play when the players consent. So if you choose to climb a tree, that's play to you. If you are forced up into the tree by your evil preschool teacher, because it says on this handout that kids like great heights, then it's not play.
Get up there. Jeff Johnson said that you like this. Get your ass up in that tree.
I just listened to a podcast. Get up in that fucking tree.
Right. Get over here and use this saw.
Yeah. Yeah. So, I mean, unless they're choosing it, unless they're consenting to it, it's not play. And I think that of course goes for all of these.
And the adult idea that just because I wouldn't maybe perhaps need to doesn't negate the child's need for it. Right. I don't need to like it. And that conversation comes up in a lot of early childhood topics. I don't need you to like Ooblik, Play-Doh, rough and tumble play. You liking it has nothing to do with how are you choosing and figuring out how to still facilitate it.
Yeah. Yeah. You need to suck it up and be the adult and understand that you might not like it, but they need it. I just thought of another dangerous element. What about critters? Because there are a lot of people that think critters are dangerous elements, whether it's bugs out on the playground or the pet spider or those kind of things. So I think that probably falls into that category. And again, running around Australia, there are playgrounds out there that have beehives on their playground, and intentionally. Because it's a way to watch the bees come and go and pollinate things, and they get the helm and honey, and there's lots of learning there. But I think I've only seen that once at a program in the States. And of course I haven't been to all the programs, but it seems to be something that's happening less often. And I mean, classroom pets, our favorite back in the day, we've talked about it in episodes. We had rats and tarantulas. And so a lot of those things would probably get the dangerous label and probably fit into that dangerous elements category as well. Should we move on from rough and tumble to the last one?
Sure.
Disappearing or getting lost. Kids like to hide. They like to have their own space. They like to be private.
Yeah. So I had a couple thoughts with this. When I first was exposed to her work, I was thinking about, you know, when you forest schools is what I was initially mm-hmm. thinking about, and the opportunity of needing to keep yourself in check of, are you constantly worried that they're going to get lost in the space that they are? And I would imagine that until the kids acclimate and get their boundaries and that sense of direction, that's always going to be, a concern perhaps, or a variable that needs to be taken into consideration. And so initially I was thinking, oh my God, it's so big, but then I whittled it down. Like, to me, disappearing or getting lost doesn't mean that you're bringing the kids to the edge of the forest. To me, this also is den making, fort making, hidey hole making, like where I think that you can't see me. And so speaking to the baby step piece of it, reminding listeners that is an element of risky play, even though it might not be as big as you know, we might be making up in our head, you know, hiding from you.
I mean, this is a big cardboard box.
Yeah.
I mean, the picture I've got on the handout is the little girl sandwich herself between two kids, solid hard plastic kids wading pools, kind of like she's coming out of a clamshell. So, I mean, this is a real easy to do. And I think most of us, do you have any pillow fort, blanket fort in the house back in growing up with the brothers?
Oh,
and
yeah. You turn the couch into a fort. You just put a sheet over a table. You just go hide behind one of the bushes in the yard. You know, like, this is my secret spot. And your mom could see us from the back, from the window in the kitchen, but we didn't think that you could see us.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, and that being able to see thing, I mean, I know me and a lot of licensing regulations probably disagree on this, but I think it's kind of cool not to have complete line of sight 24 hours a day on all the kids all the time, because we humans do need and like a little bit of privacy, which is, I mean, why I don't like classroom cameras that everybody can access all the time on the webs. But I think supporting this one is kind of hard to work into the regulations in some locations, because there's a lot of places that want you to have direct line of sight on all the kids all the time, which is, I mean, let's face it, that's just about fucking impossible to do anyway.
And it gets, I mean, that's a whole slippery slope conversation. It gets kind of crazy, especially in a family childcare setting, where now you expect, you know, one kid has to go pee and he's 4 and a half and he's been here with me since he was 6 weeks old, but I got to cart 6 other kids with me to go stand in the door jam while he goes to the bathroom.
Well,
so that's completely ridiculous.
Well, I've heard the same thing from family child care providers who feel that they have to drag all the kids to the bathroom when they want to pee. So I mean, that's really dedication to the job. I don't think you have to do that if you're an investment banker.
No, you don't. I think playing hide and go seek is even an element of this. I think if you have your own kid who likes to hide in between the clothes racks when you go shopping, it's this, right? So it doesn't have to be in the wide open forest, you know, or some big, huge national park. There's an element of this that can happen on a daily level.
Well, hell, depending on your age, putting your hands over your eyes or closing them is a version of this. I mean, it really is.
That is true.
So I think, I mean, and embracing this, you create an environment where it's possible for kids to have those places. And I mean, if that means you just have some big old sheets or blankets around that they can build blanket forts in your program, or cardboard boxes. This is a real easy to accomplish one. Excuse me. Shouldn't be drinking bourbon at 9 a.m. I apologize.
I fell down the rabbit hole a couple of years ago and I didn't realize there was a, like, I don't want to say discipline because I don't want to speak out of turn, but I fell down the rabbit hole of den play. And oh my gosh, some of the pictures, the articles are fantastic. Some of the images of the creations and the dens and the forts that kids have made. Oh my gosh, it was absolutely amazing. And you're like, oh my God, they're using a bunch of junk. None of this costs money. The investment is time. It's a time investment and an investment on the part of the adults to realize that there is inherent value to this play. Like I've just said, even though maybe you yourself would not want to spend 2 hours making a fort.
Yeah.
Somebody else does.
We built some forts back in the day. I mean, it was, and I mean, this was stuff we did when we were, I mean, 5, 6, 7 years old, but it was stuff we were still doing when we were in middle school, and the forts got a lot more advanced. I mean, at one buddy's house, we had a tunnel with a battery operated lights in it that went into the side of a hill, probably 15 feet. Their father ended up filling in with concrete, at some point, just so the side of the hill didn't collapse. We would dig out these holes and then put plywood over the top of them, and boards, and then cover earth over them with an entrance you had to crawl in. And in one buddy's backyard, we built a 2-story fort. I mean, so that we could have a crow's nest up above. So, top of it, standing on the roof, you were probably 12 foot up in the air. And all this stuff was just done with bits and pieces of lumber that we hauled out of people's garages and nails. You had to spend 5 minutes straightening before you could pound them in, and hammers snuck out of father's toolboxes and all that kind of stuff. But it was delightful. And, I've got some woods right outside the door here. And if I could get the hounds to help a little bit, I might go build myself a cubby this winter.
I always loved it when I'd be running on the trails, up in New York, and you would see like evidence of pop-up fort building over the weekend, you know, stuff that wasn't there. And sometimes, I'll be honest, in the woods, it had a little kind of a creepy Blair Witch vibe every now and again, especially when they would put the like long tree poles up vertically, right? And it would look like this triangle shaped structure, and it would just have appeared as quickly like overnight, and then it would be gone, you know, or used or added to, or moved to a more secluded spot. I always love that.
Yeah. Well, I mean, some places you don't know if that's kids at play or homeless encampments. I mean,
or yeah, or witchy business or whatever.
Yeah.
Going
on. Yeah, exactly. Exactly. Well, that's the six of them. Great heights, rapid speeds, dangerous tools, dangerous elements, rough and tumble, and disappearing or getting lost. I think this kind of adds to our ongoing efforts to kind of understand play here in the podcast. And I think this really kind of, these just sound right to me. I think that's when I read these for the first time, it just said, yeah, that makes sense. Is there any more you'd add to this list? I don't want to put you on the spot, but I was thinking about this earlier, and I couldn't really think of anything that I would add to this as a number seven.
I had a couple thoughts this morning, not necessarily of adding to. I was obviously noticed and realized that where are they all present? And my experience of the very few places where all of these are present have been in adventure playgrounds, right? Yeah. I think you see elements, and I address this in the book, is that, you know, you might not have children climbing up 14 feet into the top of a tree in your child care center program, but you probably have kids potentially climbing up a ladder or climbing, you know, scaling something. So I think that there's elements of this that can be captured in just your basic run of the mill childcare, family childcare program. I wondered this morning though, if what the implications might be when children want nothing to do with any of them. Mm-hmm. And I wondered if anybody had done any work on that. Again, it's a half-baked thought. I got nothing other than, it was a pondering this morning.
Yeah. And I think two other categories that I think we sometimes forget about when we talk about risky play, that I don't think they belong on this list, but I think we need to pay more attention to the social risk in play, socially risky play. You got to put yourself out there socially and emotionally risky play. Heather Shoemaker, I think, writes about these I think it's okay not to share. About those are risks too for kids.
Well, yeah, somebody could say, I don't want to play with you.
Yeah. Yeah. And so that play goes on all the time in early learning settings. And I just don't think we attune ourselves to it maybe as much. And I know we've touched on it. Maybe we have to come back and do whole episodes on those at some point, but I think they're a addendum to this list, but they don't belong here. This is a different thing, but they kind of fall under the category of risky play.
Mark Armitage said, and I plopped this quote in my book, was that he advised caution of thinking that risky play was a type of play. He said that risky play is what children do to some degree, right? So to be mindful of it not being a category per se. And I thought that was some good food for thought.
Yeah, that's interesting. Any final thoughts on this one before we wrap her up?
No, I think we're good. Oh, say her name. Let's say her name again, so people know who we've been talking about. Ellen Sandsetter.
Sandsetter. And I'm getting feedback on myself. I don't know where that came from. I will probably remember to put the link to this handout we've been talking about in the show notes. I wrote it down, so that's further than I usually get now. Just we'll see if I see if I read it when I'm actually putting things together. Back soon with another episode. Thanks for listening. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Well, that's all we need to get to our recording weekend at the end of November. Do you want to do another one? Are we good, or what do you want to do?
I say we'd be good, and let's forward these to November.
Yep.
Does that work?
We'll save those and see whatever guests anybody you've been thinking about that you've run into that might be good guest material if we want to bring in some fresh.
Not off the top of my head, but I can add that to my things to think about list.
Okay. And if you do the Facebook thing, I'll get you set up I'll be editing these and a bunch of new nerd things, probably over the weekend. So if you do it before then, I can get it set up in this next batch. that I'm going to do. And if you want to do a try to live thing sometime, I think my calendar looks like Wednesday evenings and mostly weekend evenings or weekend any times are pretty flexible if there's something like that that fits in your schedule. So,
okay.
So just let me know if that's something you want to try and then we can go from there.
Sweet.
Ruby, enjoy the rest of the day. Thank you.
I will. Thank you. See ya.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
This has been an Explorations Early Learning Upstairs Studio production.